Hi, everybody. Welcome again to another episode of F This Movie, the most overachieving podcast on the internet. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined tonight once again by the patron saint of F This Movie, Mr. Eric Asperschlager.
Saint Eric Asperschlager.
Saint I mean, Eric.
If you're going to say that I'm patron saint, I think you should stick true to that.
All right. Eric, of course, is a writer for DVD Verdict and has been on the show before, and is the person who figured out how to get all of our shows into iTunes. Not just 50, all of them.
All of them.
All of them.
You know, it took 52. A little bit of, it took some work.
Yeah.
I have to say that I had to go down to Apple and hand out more than a few Steve Jobs, if you know what I mean. But but I made it happen.
Is that the first time you've used that joke? I feel like that's like you've got that
the,
one.
It's the first time I've said it out loud.
Okay.
No, I mean, pretty much from the moment I figured out the iTunes thing and knowing that I would eventually be on this podcast,
yeah.
I had that in my back pocket.
Ready to give out some Steve Jobs. Wow.
I'm not sure what that entails. Turtlenecks and probably unibody aluminum enclosures.
Just let the audience's mind run wild.
This is a podcast. This is an audio, you know, journey. This
theater of the mind, if you
will. That's exactly what I was going for. But yeah. But missing completely. So yeah, so I'm happy to be back on.
Thank you for coming back on. F This Movie, you can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com, and you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. You can find us at dvdverdictpresents.com, or of course in the iTunes store, as we mentioned, by searching F This Movie. And you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. Every week when I do that, I get faster because I'm more and more bored with all that stuff. So I'm just plowing through it at this point.
We also have, you know, more and more outlets now with the Twitters and the Facebooks.
I know.
Not the YouTubes, but
no.
You could be on the YouTubes.
It could happen in the near future. I mean,
I don't know what you do, but.
Well, just these outstanding video Skypes, you know, I'll just put up the film of this because that would be interesting to watch for people. And now you, sir, are on Twitter as well. Do you want to plug your Twitter?
Yeah, I just recently got on there. It's one of those things where I heard about Twitter for so long, and it got to the point where I felt like, okay, I haven't started on Twitter, so why bother now? But I am now. Now I really am, and I occasionally tweet things. So you can follow me at Asper Slobber. That's AsperSlobber. I couldn't even go with my actual last name because my sister has that. I don't think she's using it. And my name's too long to actually – like you have like Patrick Bromley, right? That's your Twitter? Your
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I think so too. And that makes perfect sense.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I didn't want to go with anything too ridiculous, but I'm kind of – with a name like Asperschlager, you got to
– So you went for Asper Slobber.
It made sense in the couple hours that I decided before the Oscars started that I wanted to be on Twitter so I could follow your guys' stuff.
But. Yeah, right. And how are you finding Twitter so far?
It's actually pretty fun. I'm checking it way more than I thought I would, and you know, at replying occasionally.
Nice.
And,
that's a thing that you can do. I still don't understand how Twitter works. I really don't.
I might be doing Twitter. I might just be typing things on a list on my iPod. It's mostly what I say, so, and there's a lot of bread and milk in Twitter, so I'm not sure, but I don't know.
Tonight we are talking about Wes Anderson's Rushmore, but before we do, I must ask the question that I ask at the beginning of every show, or sometimes like a half hour into every show, which is, have you seen anything good lately?
In preparation for this podcast, for a while now, I've been trying to go through my Netflix instant watch queue because it has grown steadily to 70 some. I think yours might even be larger than that.
I think mine's in the 400s. So it's a losing battle. It is.
I mean, I don't think there are enough hours left in either of our lifetimes.
No. It is an Everest I will never climb.
Yeah, kind of all. It's the eyes larger than your stomach.
That's right.
Buffet syndrome. But but anyway, I decided to look at what I had and find something that might be appropriate. For our discussion this week. So I actually found an old Bill Murray movie that I hadn't seen. So I watched Stripes.
Oh, okay.
I think I'd seen bits and pieces, but I'd never seen it all the way through.
Okay. And what did you think of Stripes?
It was okay. It's weird because it is an 80s R-rated comedy, which means there is a lot of random gratuitous nudity.
Right.
That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Kind of comes out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I... I get the sense that that existed in 80s comedies because movies had not yet become as depraved as they are now.
Okay.
So whereas now in R-rated comedy, you'll get the occasional, boob and so on. But it's really just filthy, filthy dialogue. That's where a lot of the laughs come. And they either they couldn't do it or they just weren't doing it back then. So so there's surprisingly, there's swearing and stuff, but it's surprisingly okay dialogue. And then just, mud wrestlers getting their tops ripped off by John Candy. So it's so it's interesting. It's also interesting because this is, Ivan Reitman directed it. It's got Bill Murray and Harold Ramis, and Bill Murray. If you haven't seen Stripes, Bill Murray is a smartass cab driver who becomes a smartass soldier recruit, and he has his run-ins with his drill sergeant, who is not really the best bad guy because he's, I think, the nicest drill sergeant in film history. I mean, it's not like, if Bill Murray were up against the drill sergeant from Full Metal Jacket, it'd be a whole different story. I mean, in that case, he would have mentally tortured John Candy to the point where he would have turned a rifle on him and then himself.
Right.
But he's just kind of, he makes them run laps and do push-ups. you probably should have read the brochure before you joined. But it's pretty decent. But it's interesting because this is Ivan Reitman, Bill Murray, Harold Ramis, and the last Ivan Reitman movie before Ghostbusters.
Yeah. So
3 years later they did Ghostbusters, which is interesting because Ghostbusters is awesome, and also because it raises the question: what if Ghostbusters had been an R-rated 80s comedy? I mean,
there would have been a lot of Zool toplessness, I think.
Yeah, I think. And, instead of Slimer just going through walls, he would have randomly ripped the tops off of women.
Right.
And I probably would not have seen it at a third
party. Right. Although maybe, I don't know.
Maybe.
I saw Revenge of the Nerds, I think, way too young. And there's just random nudity in that, too. So
I think a theme, common theme of this podcast is you watching things way too young.
Perhaps. I believe so.
Although maybe I'm reading too much into it.
Bad supervision? I don't know. Well, I don't know. I mean, do you think I'm too young to have seen Sucker Punch? I'm a pretty old guy at this point.
Yeah, you're what, 17, 18? I mean,
I just turned 18.
Yeah, man. I mean, obviously you had an adult go with you.
Right.
Who was able
to
explain some of the slow motion shots.
Stripes is one of those movies that, like, there's this canon of sort of late 70s, early 80s comedies, like Animal House and Blues Brothers and Stripes and Caddyshack. And it's like people revere them so much. And if you ever dare to tell someone, like, oh, yeah, I've never seen it, they can't believe you haven't seen it. And it's kind of a hard thing, I think, to, like, go back and watch some of those now and appreciate them for being as funny as maybe they were in like 1982. Stripes for me kind of gets a pass because I love Bill Murray, and it's Bill Murray really doing Bill Murray. But otherwise there's not a ton of funny stuff in Stripes, really.
No, there's not. I mean, I guess Stripes is probably the least revered of the ones you mentioned because Animal House and Caddyshack.
Right.
Neither of which, when I finally got around to watching them, I was that floored by. I mean, I think I should go back and rewatch at least Caddyshack because I don't know. Maybe not. You're shaking your head.
I don't really see it with Caddyshack. Yeah. I mean,
yeah, it was totally fine. I mean, I love Bill Murray, so his stuff, was great, but I've never been a huge Chevy Chase fan, and, Rodney Dangerfield has his advantages, but it didn't, nothing about it really said, wow, this is the holy grail of comedy.
Right. Unless you love golf, I guess. I don't know, but, I'm not a golfer.
Maybe. No,
I don't know.
Do you think everyone who loves Caddyshack is a golfer?
I don't. Some people just love poo in pools because that's a big joke in that movie too, right? Anything else on Netflix Instant recently?
No, not really. Some random stuff I watched. On Hulu because I can watch that at work. I shouldn't say that out loud, but I can have it open in the corner while
sure.
I'm doing stuff. I saw a documentary, I'm gonna get the name wrong. I think it's Nightmare in Red, White, and Blue, or Nightmares in Red, White, and Blue.
Saw that on Netflix also, I think.
Yeah, I think pretty much every documentary is available on both Netflix and Hulu. But that was interesting, kind of the history of horror films in America, mm-hmm. and really getting into, how the different trends in horror films tied into the psyche of, the American people and what happened when we went to war and how that affected things and et cetera, et cetera. I've said listening to F This Movie has made me more interested in checking out horror films.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's a genre that I like, but, you know, you guys talk enough about that kind of stuff that it, you know, you have more influence on me than you think.
Nice. I like this. What can I use? What kind of evil purposes can I use? If I'm going to start just talking about how much I love terrible movies, just to see if you'll be like, well, maybe,
I don't know.
I mean, if he says Catwoman is good, maybe I should give it a look. Joke's on you.
Adding it to my queue right now.
Last night I went to see a Korean movie called I Saw the Devil.
Okay, this is Kim Ji. Oh boy,
Kim Ji Woon, I think.
Kim Ji Woon, yeah.
Yeah. He did The Good, the Bad, and the Weird was his most recent movie, and it's very good, but also one of the most difficult movies to sit through that I've ever encountered. It was, and I have a pretty high tolerance for, as we were just saying, you know, I see a lot of horror movies, so I have a pretty high tolerance for violence. I don't particularly love it, but I can handle it. But when it's done in such a way where it feels more real, I mean, horror movies, it's like there's no consequences to the violence. It's all just a cartoon. But movies like this that treat it very realistically, it's tough to sit through. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend it to everyone, but if you are a fan of sort of the darker, edgier sort of Asian cinema, you should definitely check it out. It's very, very good.
There's a huge kind of genre of these Korean revenge films, apparently, mm-hmm. that I haven't been tuned into before, but I want to check some of them out. There's a film that I've heard talked about in high esteem that's mm-hmm. on Netflix. What have I had in my queue called Mother? Is that, have you seen that one?
I have only gotten through half of Mother, and I really want to finish it. But yeah, that's Bong Joon-ho, and the half that I've seen is very mm-hmm. good. But mm-hmm. but like I know that it's going somewhere that I don't. It's not the kind of movie where you can really like predict, okay, I know exactly where this is going. So since mm-hmm. I know, especially because a lot of these movies do tend to go in strange directions that maybe you don't see coming, I'm anticipating that. So I can't say yet if it's great or not, but I like the half that I've seen.
Yeah, well, someday I may eventually get around to watching it.
Yeah, well, you have 69 other movies to watch first.
No.
Yeah, I watched a Korean movie a couple weeks ago that I reviewed for DVD Verdict, the site that we both write for at DVDverdict.com. Everybody should check it out. Called The Man from Nowhere. And mm-hmm. that's really, really good, too. You should keep your eye open for that. It's basically kind of a reworking of Man on Fire. I mean, not officially, but the plot is very, very similar. And but it's fantastic. So, and I didn't know anything about it, which is always nice when you can go into a movie totally blind and be so pleasantly surprised, because it happens so rarely.
Yeah.
So yeah, check those out. Check out I Saw the Devil, maybe, and The Man from Nowhere,
and Stripes,
and also Stripes.
I mean, I think that's a triple feature right there.
I think so. Make sure you put Stripes last. Or first. I can't tell.
Well, I mean, there's a pretty graphic scene of Harold Ramis getting his head chopped off.
Spoilers for Stripes, everyone.
The geyser of blood is hilarious.
All right, so let's talk about Rushmore then. When I first saw the trailer for Rushmore, which is Wes Anderson's second movie, he made a small movie called Bottle Rocket in like 96, and then Rushmore came out in 98. And the first time I saw the trailer for Rushmore, it looked so different from everything else I was seeing at the time. The stylization that has become Wes Anderson's, you know, trademark was really apparent even in the trailer, and I was so super excited to see that movie. And I kept having to wait because it was like a slow rollout. They opened it in New York and LA, and some of us don't live in New York. So I kept having to wait, and when I finally saw it, obviously, I fell in love with it. I really, really loved that movie, and again, you know, sometimes we tend to choose movies that we just gush over on F This Movie, and this may be one of those times. I don't know. What are your initial thoughts on Rushmore?
Yeah, well, that's it's funny you say all that, because that's kind of similar to my Rushmore journey. But I remember in college, my senior year in college, I worked on the newspaper. There were four of us, myself and Dave Johnson, who also writes for DVD Verdict, colleague, right, and a couple of our friends, and we basically did the newspaper. And the nice thing about that is that we had an office with computers that were hooked to the internet. And then we discovered, hey, you can watch movie trailers online. And this was like 98, 99. Nice. So it was still pretty early. But that's how we saw the Phantom Menace trailer for the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, et cetera, times.
Thank God that never disappointed.
I know. Boy, that was a great couple minutes. but while I was poking around, I found this trailer for this movie I'd never heard of called Rushmore, and it struck me the same way as you. Just that trailer really, you know, made it seem like I really have to watch this movie. And it took probably maybe even longer for me to see it, just because I live even further away from a major metropolitan area. I think I probably saw it for the first time on DVD, and this would have been, I don't know, probably like a 99-ish. Mm-hmm. And I remember loving it. I remember watching the heck out of it. And not terribly long ago, you did an episode with JB where you talked about The Graduate. And you know, I think you both said that that was a movie that you watched at just the right time for it to have kind of the maximum impact on you. And the same was true for me with The Graduate, and it was also very much true for Rushmore. For whatever reason, I guess watching it coming right out of college, and you know, it being a movie about kind of figuring out who you are and what your strengths are and what you want to do. And it's just quirky and it's funny, but it's also got a great kind of character arcs and serious stuff too. I mean, it's all the stuff that Wes Anderson does well. Mm-hmm. And it really stuck with me. And like, for a long time, if anyone had asked me, what's your favorite movie after some hemming and hawing, I probably would have said Rushmore.
No kidding.
That's probably not the case now.
Because you saw Stripes, finally.
Exactly. I mean, sorry, but if I'm going to rank Bill Murray movies. Rushmore just sort of always struck me as being this kind of perfect encapsulated, you know, experience. Having rewatched it recently for the first time in, I don't know, 5-6 years, I don't know if I would necessarily say that as definitively, but we could talk about that soon enough. But for a long time, Rushmore really was this is, you know, a great, great movie. It is a great movie, but yeah, it stuck with me.
Yeah, definitely. What if someone were to ask you today, what's your favorite movie? What would you say?
I don't know. I mean,
it's hard to pick just one.
It is. I mean, it changes. This is going to sound not dumb, but totally predictable. But at the moment, I might have to say Scott Pilgrim, actually. Okay. Or something like that. I mean, that's a movie that sort of strikes me as being pretty near flawless in the same way that Rushmore was. And it's totally personal. I can't objectively say that either of those movies are the greatest movie ever made. But just for the way that I experienced them.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's a difference, obviously, between what do you think is the best movie and what's your favorite movie. Because I don't know how many people say, you know, my favorite movie of all time is Citizen Kane. And if they do say that, they might be a douchebag. I couldn't say for sure, right. But I think it's possible.
Whew, I'm so glad I didn't say Citizen Kane right there.
It's no one's favorite. Like, okay, maybe you say it's the best, but it's no one's favorite.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, so this was the first time I'd seen Rushmore in a long time too, and I predict we're going to end up talking about sort of Wes Anderson in general, because you kind of can't talk about one of his movies without talking about all of his movies, I don't think. But The Royal Tenenbaums is sort of, which is the movie that he made after Rushmore, has always stood out to me as my favorite of his movies. With Rushmore being like almost like a minor version of The Royal Tenenbaums. But mm-hmm. When I rewatched Rushmore, as I was watching it, I was struck with the feeling like, no, maybe this one's my favorite. I don't know, because it is smaller, but I also think it's a better kind of a character study than The Royal Tenenbaums. And I think it's less inclined towards that sort of arch preciousness that Royal Tenenbaums gets into somewhat. Mm-hmm. Just to be sure, I then put on Royal Tenenbaums, and I do still really, really love it. I don't know if I could choose one over the other, but I was really impressed by what control he has in Rushmore and how he doesn't really ever push a moment. He doesn't ever oversell some of the, you know, now he's sort of associated with this very busy, very self-conscious production design. Every inch of the frame is carefully chosen and there's just stuff everywhere and all of his shots are very carefully calculated. And there's a lot of that in Rushmore, but it's, I think, a little more minimalistic. It doesn't overwhelm what's happening. And I think some of Wes Anderson's later stuff, it does kind of overwhelm what's happening on screen. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, Max Fisher in Rushmore is one of his two best characters ever. Royal Tenenbaum, played by Gene Hackman in the Royal Tenenbaums, obviously being the second. And I respond to them both in sort of a similar way in that they're such complicated characters in that they're so sort of unlikable, and yet you really like them. They get away with so much. They engender so much goodwill despite acting in a way that is inexcusable most of the
right,
time.
Right. Yeah, that's certainly true of Max. I think Max gets an even more of a pass because he's 15 years old.
Right.
And I think that is one of the kind of strengths of Rushmore is that, in some of Wes Anderson's later movies, the characters can be pretty unlikable, even though their arcs can end on a high note. You can think of Bill Murray's character in Life Aquatic. You know, he's very kind of self-centered and kind of into himself, to the point where people are kind of dying around him, and he's not really kind of reacting. But Max, Max Fisher, he acts like a kid. I mean, that's what he does. And, it's interesting to see other characters also act like kids. I mean, Bill Murray's character in Rushmore, Herman Bloom, kind of matches Max, when they get in this, this back and forth contest kind of, rivalry that turns into a feud. As the Miss Cross character says later on, they're both children, mm-hmm. But they're kind of on different ends. Max is on the way up and Bloom's kind of on the way down. I think you're right that it is a more focused movie. Wes Anderson gets very ambitious very fast. And there's a definite trajectory to his movies. Bottle Rocket is more focused or kind of more minimal. Then Rushmore, and then Royal Tenenbaums kind of all of a sudden it just kind of explodes and it becomes this, this massive ensemble piece. And he kind of continues that, at least in Life Aquatic. And then by the time we get to Darjeeling Limited, which is a movie that I like as well. I like all of them, but, I think what struck me about that movie when I watched it for the first time was how kind of scaled back it was and how kind of Rushmore like it was in that it just focuses on a few main characters, mm-hmm. and doesn't get into this massive history of this entire family or all these subplots and sub characters and all that kind of stuff. But what was your question?
Not to get off on like too far of a Wes Anderson sort of tangent, my problems with Life Aquatic is a movie I have a lot of problems with just in general, but I at least admired that I felt like when I first saw Life Aquatic, I didn't really like it, but it seemed like, okay, he's sort of trying to push himself in a different direction, at least tonally, because there are so many of the same, the overdone production design and the ensemble cast, and a lot of even cast members show up again. So there's a lot of the hallmarks of a Wes Anderson movie, but I thought he's sort of at least trying to make a different movie. I don't think he succeeded really at making a very good movie. And Darjeeling Limited I like better, but to me it felt like he was just sort of repeating himself by that point, that I didn't really feel like Darjeeling Limited had anything to say that he hadn't already said in three or four prior movies. And maybe that's part of what I love about Rushmore too, is that he wasn't repeating himself yet. Everything still sort of felt new. And a lot of his movies, especially Tenenbaums and Life Aquatic and Darjeeling Limited and even Fantastic Mr. Fox, are really just about like father issues. A lot of his movies are really about father issues.
I think all of his movies are.
Yeah, but Rushmore on the surface you think could be, because you look at the Max Fisher and Mr. Bloom relationship as a father-son thing, but something I noticed watching it this time and was confirmed, I tried to listen to a little bit of the commentary track on the DVD, and it's either Owen Wilson, who co-wrote the movie with Wes Anderson, which is another thing I'll go back to that. The best movies seem to be written by the two of them. Mm-hmm. Once they stopped writing together, I think Wes Anderson went off the rails a little bit. One of the two of them confirms that they really wanted the relationship between Bloom and Max to not be father-son. They wanted it to be a friendship of equals. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes across.
It's less of a father issue movie. I think the later movies are very much a, you know, kids versus parents. There is a father-son relationship to Max and Bloom, although at times it's hard to know who's being the parent and who's being the kid.
Right.
Because it does go back and forth. And there is obviously a whole kind of subplot to Rushmore that involves Max and his actual father.
Right.
And that provides some of the kind of the sweeter moments and kind of the breakthrough near the end when he kind of comes clean about who he is and who his family is and kind of owns it. But you're right. It is about the same themes that Anderson looks at in all of his movies, but in a less on the nose way. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, we can, you know, we'll talk about Rushmore eventually, but I rewatched Life Aquatic this past week, preparing for the podcast. And it was a movie I had the same reaction you did when I watched it the first time. Like, it was not at all what I expected it to be. I found, you know, tonally to be kind of jarring and all over the place. And I didn't like the characters that much. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't crazy about Owen Wilson's character. He kind of plays a very wooden guy. But watching it again, I really liked it the second time around.
Okay.
I think there's a lot to unpack in it. I don't think it's, you know, flawless or perfect. It's very ambitious. And it's very kind of European and you know, he's definitely put on the, what some might call pretentious director auteur's hat there. You know, I think he's sincere about it. So I'm willing to give him latitude when he, records a commentary from a bistro where they sat and wrote the entire movie and had swordfish and all this kind of stuff. But, and it's interesting too, again, watching Rushmore after watching Life Aquatic again, you see the whole thing with the aquarium and Jacques Cousteau. There's a little hint of places that he would eventually go. You almost get the sense that all of his movies are just chapters in a book that he's, mm-hmm. you know, a larger story, complicated story that, you know, maybe is unrelated, but they're all, you know, even the fact that he brings back the same people movie to movie. It's almost like everyone's kind of playing in his world and he has these things he wants to deal with and talk about. But for each movie, he just kind of dresses the sets a bit differently and, you know, puts it either underwater or in India or at a, you know, boarding school and just sort of has at it. And
right. See what... Or makes them all talking animals.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, you know, to me, like, Rushmore definitely feels like the logical extension of Bottle Rocket, and Tenenbaums feels like the logical progression of Rushmore. But Tenenbaums, like you had said, is so sort of big. It encompasses so much and so many characters, and there's so much going on in that movie that sort of felt like his opus. And it's like, I feel like he needed to go somewhere else. And he did a little bit with Life Aquatic, like you said, but I don't know. I don't want to see him keep making the same movie where it's like, I'm going to go see the new Wes Anderson movie, same as the old Wes Anderson movie. And I was, in listening to the commentary track on Rushmore, I was amazed to hear how much of the movie, and maybe I shouldn't have been amazed, is sort of autobiographical. Throughout the commentary, they're just pointing out, that came from me, that came from, you know, Owen Wilson says, that came from me, he got kicked out of school, or like the speech that Bloom gives about mm-hmm. find the rich kids and get them in your sights, like that right. came from Owen Wilson's dad, I think. Mm-hmm. That there's a lot of elements in the film that are very autobiographical. And I guess that's why, for all of its sort of mannered formalism, I mean, Wes Anderson is a very formalist director, but it's still so grounded in, you know, relatable human emotion, because it's not just people, you know, making these things up. These are things that they've lived through, and they're sort of able to infuse that in the movie.
Yeah, I think that it's almost like there is an arc or a, you know, kind of a Wes Anderson scale. And depending on your tolerance for the Andersonness of the movies, you kind of jump out at a certain point. I mean, it could be Rushmore. I mean, Rushmore is, you know, just a step up. It's not completely out there. He's not completely, you know, embracing the visual stuff that he would really, you know, grab onto later in his movies. And then you get to Royal Tenenbaums, where it kind of really gets ambitious and it starts to kind of really move in that territory, but there's enough kind of grounded stuff that, and it's small enough in scope that it's not crazy. And then you get to Life Aquatic, which is a very, very ambitious movie. I mean, he's doing a lot, you know, not only with the characters, but in, it's hard to describe. I mean, it is sort of an homage to a lot of European directors. I mean, he's really going out there. He's got the stop motion animation. He's got, you know, the whole kind of Moby Dick thing. He's got,
there's like,
he's got
gunfights and pirates.
I mean,
and
sure, people, I mean, people die. People get like a guy gets a, you know, machete buried in his shoulder. It's not, you know, it is a very different, you know, ambitious. It's an ambitious movie. I mean, whether it works ultimately or not, I mean, I probably would say that, kind of respond that I don't know that he's making the same movie over and over again. He's just, his style is just so distinct that it really feels that way. I mean, you can tell that it's a Wes Anderson movie in some way. If you have a really distinctive singer, you know their voice, and you say, well, that's a such song. But, you know, part of that is just that for whatever reason, I really respond to what he does. So I'm willing to give him maybe some more latitude. If you get someone like Steven Spielberg, I mean, his movies are kind of, well, not all of them, but most of them are about, you know, childhood and you know, that kind of stuff. So, you know, you wouldn't say that he makes the same movies over and over again. Or maybe you would.
No, and Life Aquatic, again, which, while it's probably my least favorite of his movies, I still appreciate that he was trying to do something different. Like I said, I don't know that it worked for me, but I totally need to see it again, because it sounds like maybe another viewing would help a lot. So I even at the time, I appreciated, like, okay, you're trying to do something different. And I don't know if it was that movie's sort of failure that led to the Darjeeling Limited, which is a movie I like, and Fantastic Mr. Fox as well. I like both of those movies. But they really have a sense of, well, we've seen you do this. We've seen you cover this, not just his style with the very specific shots and the production design and all that. That's okay. That's part of his style. But even thematically, I felt like, oh, you're covering ground that you've already covered. Whereas in Life Aquatic, you know, he's not really, he's trying to do something different. So I do appreciate that.
Yeah. I mean, the movies all seem to be kind of different stops along the same journey. You know, that has to do with not only the kind of parent child relationships and, but also just kind of the development of a person from, you know, early childhood and school years up through dealing with death and dealing with, you know, setting out on adventures and I guess with Fantastic Mr. Fox, you know, the humanness of wild animals and the wildness of humans and all that kind of stuff. But I think there are probably a few things that for me, I like so much about what he does, or he does so well, that it kind of sucks me in even when I'm not 100% on board with what he is doing.
Sure.
One of those is the music, and we can probably talk a lot about the music. I mean, the Rushmore, you know, is very distinctive. I think that's one of the things, even from the trailer, that really struck me. And then watching the movie, you know, now it's kind of like, oh, it's Wes Anderson. He's going to have a great soundtrack. But, you know, at the time, it just really... it really struck me, and I've seen he probably uses licensed music better than almost anyone else right now in movies. You know, yes, I love British Invasion music, so that helps. It's interesting to see that he's not, you know, as movies went on, in Rushmore, it's kind of a grab bag. Royal Tenenbaums, a little bit kind of a grab bag. And then when he gets to Life Aquatic, he, you know, it's a lot of David Bowie songs, many of which are translated into Portuguese and sung by Seu Jorge, and then in Darjeeling Limited, it's Kink songs mixed with music from old Merchant Ivory and Senyajit Ray movies, and so there's a lot of interesting, you know, music, and I think I have to say that probably one of the reasons that I love Darjeeling Limited as much as I did when I first watched it has to do with the fact that he used songs from the Kinks' Lola versus Power Man and the Money Go Round album, which is a great album. So he knows me. He's got my musical number, as it were.
Right. And I definitely freaked out for the Darjeeling Limited trailer because he used both of those mm-hmm. Kinks songs. It was This Time Tomorrow and yeah.
It was either Strangers.
It was yeah. Strangers. And man, are those great. And they so work in the trailer. But again, to me, that sort of speaks to the fact that, like, by Darjeeling Limited, he was on autopilot a little bit because his plan for Rushmore was at one point to just use Kinks music. And it was like, well, I didn't do that. So by the time he gets to Darjeeling, he's recycling ideas from three movies ago. And again, it works in the movie and I like the music. And you're absolutely right about how well he uses music, because man, we sit through so many movies where music is either not even thought about or is just insulting, and so it's so great to see somebody like Wes Anderson, or I mean, there's a hand, you know, Quentin Tarantino
sure
is great, and I would say Scorsese, but you know, how many times can you use Give Me Shelter in a movie? But like, Wes Anderson and Quentin Tarantino are the two that really elevate, each thing elevates the other, where now those songs are forever linked in your mind, and you like the song better because of the way it's used in the movie, and you like the movie better because of the way the song is playing under the action.
It's not just that it's a cool song. It's that the lyrics and the tone of the song meld with the emotion in the scene. I mean,
even the vibe of the whole thing, you know, the fact that he uses so many of these like 60s songs, British Invasion songs. I mean, his movies all have that feel too. There's a very sort of retro feel to what he's doing. The first time I saw that Rushmore trailer, I didn't know Making Time by The Creation. Yeah, right. I didn't know that song, but man, that just grabs you and you're like, I gotta see that, because that is an awesome song.
I mean, that's the Rushmore song, the point when I actually got a hold of the song on Nuggets, it was like, oh, there's more to it than that.
Can I tell you something? That's the exact same thing I did. We went out and bought Nuggets because had Making Time on it. Yeah, Rushmore has great music throughout. Let me ask you a question. I'm going to skip all the way to the end of Rushmore, because again, so spoilers for Rushmore if you haven't seen it. I don't know why you're listening at this point if you haven't, but see Rushmore because it's great. Listening to the commentary, both I think Owen Wilson and Wes Anderson talk about the fact that it's sort of that the movie is left open-ended, that the last shot we see is Max dancing with Miss Cross. Mm-hmm. And they both kind of say, you know, I mean, I don't know if they end up together. And I thought that was such an odd statement, because it never occurred to me that they would. And I don't think the movie even steers things that way. I think the movie is very clear about where their lives are headed. And that isn't it. Am I
right? No, not at all. I mean, one of the things that I was going to say, the other thing about Wes Anderson movies that really gets me is that he's so good at endings.
Yeah.
For some reason, like, even when I was watching Rushmore, there were certain points in it that I was starting to think, well, he's kind of repeating himself a little bit here, and then not crazy about the bike accident scene and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Then you get to the ending where you have the play and then the cotillion, and that whole section is just thrilling. And then it ends, like you say, on what seems like a very kind of nicely, neatly packaged, you know, point. You got, you've got the faces playing. You've got everyone dancing, kind of slow-mo. Everyone's together. You brought all the supporting characters together. And, you know, Max is dating Margaret Yang. And Miss Cross maybe seems like she might be getting back together with Herman Bloom. And everyone's totally happy. And maybe they just think about it too much. Because they really seem like, you know, the curtain closed, all right?
Right.
Close at the end.
And they say, so, you know, they think maybe Max is still in love with Miss Cross. And maybe that's the case. But I just feel like if he was still in love with her, if he was still working an angle to try and get with her the way he does so much throughout the movie, I don't feel like when she says, when he says, no one got hurt, and she says, well, you did, and he says, not that bad.
Right.
I don't feel like he would have said not that bad. He would have been trying to play up the sympathy angle, right? If he was still trying to make her fall in love with him.
That's gotta just be, you know, writers who have kind of inhabit, or, you know, have their lives inhabited by these characters, not wanting to let go. I mean, I guess when you finish a book or a movie or something, you got to think, well, what happens to these characters once, you know, they're part me. So what's happening now? Whereas we just think, movie's over. That was great.
Yeah, right. And I always hate to think, sometimes commentaries do spoil things for me because I'll listen to a commentary track for maybe a romantic comedy or something, not a generic one. There's a very specific example right now in my head, but I can't think of what it is, where the director or the writer even says, I don't see a future for these two. I don't think they're going to end up together. And I hated hearing that because right. when a movie ends and it leads me to believe that these two people are going to be together, that's what I want to believe. You know, I don't want to think and then 6 months from now they break up, because if that's the case, what was all this for? Why did you take me through this whole emotional journey to know that it's temporary, you know?
Yeah. That's got to just be kind of a mindset of the writer. I mean, you have to imagine the characters beyond what you've actually written down in order to kind of flesh out what you've written.
Right.
I mean, there are people, I think my wife included, who think about who kind of wonder what characters are doing or have done after we finish watching something. You know, mm-hmm. I wonder what this character is doing now. I've never asked myself that question right. ever about a movie or a book or anything. It's like, okay, the story's over.
Right.
You know, I moved on. Maybe that's because I'm a guy. Who knows? I don't know.
My wife kind of does that with TV shows, not as much with movies, but we finished The Wire and she still wanted to live in that world and know what was happening. And I was like, what? No, it's over. Let's move on to the next thing.
Yeah. I mean, because she's not going to listen to this, I can say that. Yeah. When we were watching Mad Men, it was the same way. She's like, yeah, I wonder what Peg is doing right now. You know, I was like, I don't know. Let's wait till Netflix gets the next season.
Yeah. Right.
I don't think in those terms, but if you write these characters, if you create them and you have to figure out what they're going to say, I guess you probably think about that stuff. So, well, I'm glad we don't find out that Max and Miss Cross ended up together.
Yeah. Right.
Because we know that Max eventually gets a mustache, runs off to Paris for a year after his father dies, and
dates Natalie Portman.
Yeah,
right. And I love Margaret Yang, and I love the way that she's introduced into the movie, and so I assume they're perfect together, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you got to the point where Max is kind of being honest with himself about the fact that he's a 15-year-old kid,
right.
And he's found someone who actually shares his interest and is interested in him and is age appropriate. And it's great. I think I think when you get to that point in the movie where Max is, like I say, is being honest, there's a really great scene between Max and Herman Bloom and Max's father when Herman Bloom is kind of at the end of his rope and Max has decided to end their rivalry, and he invites him to the barber shop to get his hair cut. And there's a great scene where he introduces him, Bloom to his father, and that gets me every time. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because he's in his Andersonian wisdom playing a song from A Charlie Brown Christmas in the background, kind of subtly on the TV, mm-hmm. which will obviously pluck the heartstrings anyway, but.
But and then he uses it again in Royal Tenenbaums.
Yeah, so there are great moments like that that kind of make it not just a quirky comedy. I mean, I wouldn't even call it necessarily a comedy. There's funny stuff in it, but the fact that characters do all this outrageous stuff and then come to these realizations about themselves, the fact they have arcs that take them from being delusional to kind of understanding what's really going on and relating to each other. Is always very satisfying to me in Wes mm-hmm. Anderson movies, that people end having learned something about themselves.
That feel like real life understandings and conclusions and mm-hmm. aren't just the machinations of a screenwriter who right. has to have someone learn a lesson by the end of the movie. That they've earned that revelation by the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why, like I say, the endings of Wes Anderson movies are always so impressive to me and always kind of leave me thinking, boy, I want to watch that again. And that totally happened with Rushmore. I've seen the movie about a billion times. Like I say, when I was watching it, there are certain things that kind of was like, well, maybe it's not quite as good as I remember it. Or, maybe he did more interesting things later on. But man, when you get to that ending, it was over. And I was like, okay, I got to watch that again.
The ending is almost identical to the Royal Tenenbaums. Sure. We have Van Morrison instead of the faces. We have the whole cast. He even does the speed ramping where it starts regular speed and then it slows down. But it is totally effective. And like you said, it works. If you are sort of attuned to his style,
yep.
you'll be a sucker for it every time, you know?
Yep.
And you had just said something that I want to point out is one of the things that I like so much about his movies, and that is that they are really, really funny, even though there aren't necessarily jokes.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that that humor is balanced with really, really, I think, strong sort of dramatic emotional stuff, more so, I think, in Royal Tenenbaums than Rushmore. Rushmore, the stakes always felt a little bit lower for me.
Sure, that's true, yeah.
And maybe it's, like you said, because he's 15 and we just feel like, well, if he gets his heart broken, he'll be okay. You know, he's going to land on his feet. And Royal Tenenbaums, the characters are a little bit older. They've been through more. And sometimes you feel like, wow, this is their last shot, particularly with Luke Wilson's character in Royal Tenenbaums,
right.
that this is it for him. And spoilers for Royal Tenenbaums coming up, if you haven't seen it, two things that get me every time. One is a great example of the way that he gets a laugh out of a dramatic scene, and that is the scene where Luke Wilson cuts his wrist mm-hmm. to the Elliot Smith song, and he's wheeled into the hospital, and it's a moving moment, and it's shot in the Wes Anderson way, and everybody's covered in blood. And then it cuts to his family getting to the hospital and saying, "Where is he?" And Dudley says, "Who?" And Dudley is the one who's been present with him the whole time. And it's this laugh that relieves what you've just been through, but doesn't undercut it.
Right, right.
It doesn't make a cheap joke out of the whole thing, but it's a genuine laugh. And then the other thing is at the end, when Ben Stiller says, I've had a rough year.
Yeah.
That gets me every time. And then he's riding with Gene Hackman in the ambulance, like that could pretty much make me cry every single time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's so earned. Mm-hmm. I mean, Gene Hackman's performance in that movie is so incredible and so like Max Fisher, I feel like, having grown up a little bit, again, in the way that he's just kind of a bastard, but you love him, and the way that Gene Hackman is able to navigate being just a horrible human being but still make you laugh is incredible to me. I feel like, not that I put a lot of stock in Oscars, but I feel like he was robbed for that
right.
movie.
I think
he's so good in that movie.
Yeah, I mean, and you look at Bill Murray's character in Life Aquatic, and he doesn't do it as well. He doesn't balance out that kind of bastardness.
He's like Royal Tenenbaum without the charm, you know?
It's just
the bad stuff about Royal.
Right, right. Yeah, no, those, when you said there are two moments in that movie that get you every time, those are exactly the two that I thought of.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's amazing to think that. I mean, Royal Tenenbaums, you've got Ben Stiller's in that movie, and Ben Stiller gives a performance and has scenes that will make me cry.
Yeah, Ben Stiller used to make good, interesting choices, though. But he hasn't for years, and it's amazing. Yeah, to watch it now and be like, "That's Ben Stiller. He's really good," you know.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
he's genuinely moving, and all you can just picture him is the guy from the Fokker movies, and you're like, "Oh, right. Ben Stiller." Right. We should talk a little bit about Bill Murray, though, because Rushmore. Rushmore was the game changer. Mm-hmm. Rushmore sort of defined the, I don't know if you would call it the second half of Bill Murray's career, but certainly the you know, this third of Bill Murray's career, where it sort of reinvented his on-screen persona, because for years he was the guy from Stripes that you were talking about, just the smartass who confronts authority and usually wins because he's awesome. But Rushmore saw sort of a sadness in him that is, you know, exactly what he did in Lost in Translation. He was nominated for an Oscar for that, and has sort of, whether it's the Jim Jarmusch movies that he's been in or the other Wes Anderson movies that he's been in, I mean, he's sort of been playing a variation on Bloom, I feel like, since mm-hmm. Rushmore came out.
Yeah, no, that's true. It's interesting. I was thinking about this today, that I sort of had this sense that he had a comeback, but it never really went anywhere. He just changed gears.
Right.
I mean, I'm not sure what he did in the early 90s, but.
Well, I mean, Groundhog Day was sort of big for him, but then the years, and it's only about 5 years, which is crazy to think about, that there's only 5 years between Groundhog Day and Rushmore, because he's
just a
totally different guy. But those were rough years. I mean, those were like The Man Who Knew Too Little and Larger Than Life, and just some kind of terrible comedies that were forgettable, you know, which is why we can't think of the names of them right now.
Right, right. And yeah, he totally came up with this version of himself that plays off of all of the things that we know him for, you know, in the Stripes era and the Groundhog Day, that kind of grown up smart ass who knows more, I guess, in the world. And, you know, we saw it in Lost in Translation and all the movies you just said. I'm not going to repeat them, but yeah, he's kind of had this second life, this second sort of indie spirit life that is kind of a perfect fit for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, he couldn't still be doing the kind of movies he was doing when he was, you know, in his 20s. Now it wouldn't make any sense, but he's, you know, he's found a way to make it work. And I don't, you know, I'm not sure how much of that you can credit Wes Anderson for, but it certainly kind of set him on that path, at least in the public eye.
Supposedly, you know, Wes Anderson wrote this screenplay with Bill Murray in mind. So right. He must have seen something in him. And I always got the feeling watching Rushmore that was much closer to who Bill Murray is than most of what he had done prior to that.
Right. It's certainly less of a caricature than
right.
We see.
Yeah, just it's kind of unhappy, and all the stuff of him with his kids makes me laugh every time.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, I mean, there's that scene that is a very, you know, sort of knowing nod to The Graduate, which you had brought up earlier, even sort of, like you said, brought you to Rushmore and to suggest it to do on the show. But and I think it was Garden State that led us to The Graduate, which led us to Rushmore. So where will Rushmore take us, I guess, is the question.
I guess we'll have to wait for Zach Braff's next movie to come out.
Perhaps. Or what if it gets us on an Olivia Williams kick and we do The Postman?
We could do The Postman. I've never seen The Postman.
Oh, you haven't lived until you've seen The Postman. That was her only other movie prior to.
Was it really?
Yeah. That was her first movie, and then she did Rushmore.
There are a lot of that. I mean, Jason Schwartzman just kind of came out of a casting call. I know he has, you know, film family roots.
Mm-hmm.
Is he related to Tom Cruise? Am I getting that?
He is not. He's
It's a Coppola.
It's Coppola, yeah.
It's a Coppola production.
Yeah.
Because at the end there, when they're doing the stage play of Heaven and Hell, he looks totally Tom Cruise like in just that moment where he's in the face paint and he's kind of shouting.
I love Heaven and Hell.
It's just a great way to end the movie. I mean, all of those, you know, stage plays that he does, and Rushmore is very unclear about exactly how talented Max Fisher actually is.
Mm-hmm.
He apparently can write and produce plays well, whether it's, you know, Serpico or Heaven and Hell or a little one act about Watergate, but it seems like everything else he does, he isn't all that great at, but he just keeps trying and trying.
Right, which is why you love the character, even though, like I said, he can act like a jerk most of the time, but he has this sort of unfailing optimism and this love for all of these things that he does. And again, not to keep referencing the commentary track on the DVD, but I don't want to pass it off like it was my idea, but they point out that Max, you know, I think it would have been easy for them to write Max because he is very much this committed artist, that he has this vision that he has to be, you know, he's uncompromising and it has to be realized. And I think in 9 out of 10 movies, that vision would be something artistic, like in air quotes, that it, you know, something just pretentious and self-serious and all that stuff. But they point out that Max really puts on these crowd pleasers that Heaven and Hell, I mean, just traffics in every war movie cliche you've ever seen. And the audience just eats it up because it's super entertaining and super ambitious. And I like that the disconnect between his sort of vision and his unwillingness to compromise, but also the fact that what he's doing isn't really art.
You know? Sure, and it may not even necessarily be what he wants to do, but what he thinks people want him to do, and that's kind of, at least ostensibly, his motivation for going after Miss Cross in the first place is that, you know, he says that all people really care about is scoring with chicks, so maybe he should focus on that. Mm-hmm. So there's, I mean, there, he definitely wants to be liked and accepted, and he has all this ambition, but it kind of comes from a place of kind of a need for approval, or just, I mean, he's hiding who he is. He's hiding who his father is. He wants to be seen as more than maybe he really is. And he just kind of really overcompensates and just kind of with an enthusiasm that causes him to go for whatever it is he wants to go for, mm-hmm. even if it's not good for him or the people around him. You know, when he goes from stage plays to relationships, it's a messy transition because he's not moving props around anymore. He's dealing with real emotions in people's lives.
But he kind of goes about it the same way, where, you know, just go bigger is better and
sure.
and go. And obviously that doesn't work when you're dealing with people's lives. But
right. And he's whether he's trying to, you know, build an aquarium because that's what he thinks that Miss Cross wants, or you know, gets Latin not only not canceled but made a required course.
Right.
A class that he had lobbied against for 5 years. He makes things happen, but at the same time, he's kind of a spectacular failure at a
right.
lot of other things
right.
too. I mean, the fact that he's you know, he's failing all of his classes and he's going to get kicked out, you know, is such a driving force for him. I mean, it almost seems like his real love, it isn't Miss Cross, and it isn't even the plays, it isn't the productions. It's Rushmore. I mean, he, you know,
right.
And almost everything he does is to stay there, is to kind of stay in that bubble, to stay in that life, to kind of be in this place, maybe because that's where he feels like people love and accept him and
right.
kind of think he's remarkable. I don't know, but
then obviously, you know, part of his growth is when he goes to the next school and he begins to embrace that and starts to, which, you know, you could say is growth because at least he's learning to love something besides Rushmore. But at the same time, it's like, no, you're just making the same sort of mistakes. But I remember being amused by that disconnect, even in the trailer, that they set up Max and they have that great montage. And in the movie, it's the making time montage mm-hmm. of all of his activities and all of his accomplishments, you know, or whatever. And then you have Brian Cox saying he's one of the worst students we have. And I just
yeah.
love that disconnect that he
yeah,
does
absolutely.
All of these things, but none of them particularly well, because it's the doing of them that he loves, not the excelling at them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
He's a lot of ambition, that kid, you know,
which
shows
again,
real
is,
potential,
which is what Bloom sort of sees in him,
sure.
you know, that this used to be me. And here's what I've built for myself, but what does any of it mean? I'm miserable, you know. I have millions of dollars and kids that can't stand me and a loveless marriage and
a pool that's just lousy with leaves.
And so, you know, again, that line where she's my Rushmore, it's a little on the nose, but
sure.
it does speak to what's at the heart of the movie, which is, you know, find this thing that you love and go for it.
Yeah, I mean, Wes Anderson's never particularly subtle about
no,
what he wants to say.
Right.
Although he's so kind of mannered in the way he writes dialogue anyway,
mm-hmm.
that it never comes across as like, oh, that's took me out of the experience. It's just kind of, you know, he likes to put thesis statements in there, and it kind
right.
of works the way he does it, at least
right.
for me.
And again, this the jokes are never, you know, underlined as jokes, and I'm jumping to Royal Tenenbaums. Perhaps the line I think is funniest in Royal Tenenbaums is at the very end, again, after you've been just really through an emotional ringer and you get Bill Murray and Dudley sitting on stage and someone asks the question, can the boy tell time? And Bill Murray's response is just, oh, heavens, no. I just love the absurdity of that.
Yeah.
And again, I have to wonder, I don't have a ton of respect for Owen Wilson anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He's sort of like Ben Stiller to me, where he started with all this credibility because he was a part of these projects that I really liked. Like the, you know, he co-wrote the first three Wes Anderson movies. And so
right.
I was just like, oh, he's the man. And then he spent just over a decade destroying that credibility with me. So it's hard for me to know who's responsible for the elements of those first three movies that I really love. But I do think it's strange that since the two of them stopped at least writing together, I haven't responded to any of the Wes Anderson movies the same. And I have the cynic in me has a hard time buying the fact that it was Owen Wilson's contributions that really made those movies work, but maybe it was.
he was the Mike Love to Wes Anderson's Brian Wilson, you know, just kind of gave him just enough, you know, commercial credibility.
Perhaps.
And when he finally just went off on his own and was playing piano in a giant sandbox, as it were, metaphorically speaking.
Metaphorically, the metaphorical giant sandbox.
Sure, a giant sandbox or ocean, if you will, or, you know, something. Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, most of what Owen Wilson has done is, you know, taking bad acting roles. I don't know if he's done any writing that I'm aware of.
No, I don't think so. Not since Royal Tenenbaums.
Maybe he's just a better writer than he is a chooser of parts to play.
And maybe that's unfair of me to make that judgment, because I see him as an actor and I have a hard time believing that he could be a great screenwriter. Like, because he's in things like You, Me, and Dupree. And I'm just like, that guy doesn't write great scripts, but somehow he's associated with three of them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how that came to be.
And even when he's not writing, I mean, in Darjeeling Limited, I think he does a great job. I mean, he's never really better than when he's in a Wes Anderson movie.
Right.
And whether that's, you know, they're friends, they had similar sensibilities, that just all kind of clicks, whatever it is. He does a really good job in those movies. I mean, Life Aquatic, he's playing a very kind of stylized character, so it's a little hard to judge. But whatever his contributions were to Rushmore and to Royal Tenenbaums, and even I think the part he plays in Royal Tenenbaums is one of the least interesting parts. I mean,
it's definitely the least interesting part.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really crazy about the whole subplot, and that might be one of the reasons why it took a while for me to really love Royal Tenenbaums, is that there are so many threads, you know, that are all happening at the same time, and not all of them, you know, interest me a lot. So either there's one or two that aren't great, it kind of drags the whole movie down. Whereas Rushmore is such a focused experience, like we said, that you know, that it all kind of works.
Is Rushmore your favorite of the Wes Anderson movies?
I don't know. I mean, I think the fact that it's less ambitious than some of his later movies, yes, it's probably more consistently good throughout, but that may just be because it's safer.
Okay.
You know, there even when something like Life Aquatic sort of stumbles, it stumbles in a very spectacular way.
Right.
So I can sort of appreciate what he's doing from a visual perspective in the later movies that you only kind of get hints at in Rushmore.
Okay.
I guess I probably would, just because, you know, Rushmore is that really, really great combination of a great script, a great look, and just an amazing cast. I mean, the fact you got Bill Murray, if you didn't have Bill Murray and Jason Schwartzman in that movie, you know, all of Wes Anderson's direction might not have made it, you know, anywhere near as good. I mean, they really were great finds. Mm-hmm. You know, a fine in Jason Schwartzman's case and a great get in Bill Murray's case.
Right.
So same way that Royal Tenenbaums, they, I think, wrote that with Gene Hackman in mind, and they were able to get him. So, you know, in the same way that Wes Anderson is able to pick the perfect Kink song for any occasion, he can divine the right actor to come in and bring a role to life. So,
do you think his career will stall when he runs out of Kink songs?
The Kinks wrote a lot of music.
Yeah, they did. They did.
I don't think I've heard anything yet from Kinks or the Village Green Preservation Society. And that's, you know, that's one of my top 10 favorite albums. So okay. I think there's plenty there.
Okay.
I mean, you know, whether it's you know, Do You Remember Walter or Village Green or Phenomenal Cat or what have you.
Get to work, Wes Anderson. There's an entire album's worth of music that we need a movie for.
I know. Well, actually, it's interesting because Fantastic Mr. Fox was talking about all this British invasion stuff, but besides Street Fighting Man, I think is the only of those songs, really. I mean, otherwise, it's like Burl Ives and the Beach Boys and...
I don't remember a lot of music in... And I've only seen Fantastic Mr. Fox once, but I don't remember... I actually think I remember Street Fighting Man now that you say it, because I remember feeling like it was out of place.
Yeah, and it probably is most out of place of the songs. There's a lot... I mean, it starts with like the Ballad of Davy Crockett. You know, it kind of goes into that, and then it kicks into Heroes and Villains by the Beach Boys. But, you know, so, you know, it's a Wes Anderson movie, but I think that, you know, that it wouldn't have worked as well, I think, that movie, if it had been all Kinks songs and Who songs and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
But
all right. Well, thank you. That's Rushmore, everybody. And you know what? It's pretty much every other Wes Anderson movie too. So we've sort of boxed ourselves in. We can't really touch the other ones now because we've covered a lot of them.
That's okay. Well, that's okay. Until he makes the next one with Zach Braff and and I don't know.
Dustin Hoffman.
I was trying to think of someone I could tie back in from earlier conversation, but I.
From The Graduate?
No, just in general.
Just anyone?
Just from our conversation tonight.
John Candy? Harold Ramis?
Steve Jobs.
Steve Jobs. Nice. Look at you bringing it full circle. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Remember, you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com if you want to nominate your favorite Wes Anderson movie and defend it. If your favorite movie is The Fantastic Mr. Fox because you love stop motion animals, listen, send us an email. Maybe we'll read it.
I can say that I probably will not read it because I don't I don't have access to your email.
I'll forward it to you, I promise.
Okay, if you forward it to me, then I'll read it.
Thanks for being on the show, Eric, and thanks for coming up with the idea of effing Rushmore.
Hey, no problem. I'm all about the effing. I am in fact the patron saint of all things effed.
Bye, everybody.